More than 50 million people suffer from allergies in this country. Can you believe that? I tell you what, that's an amazing figure. We spend $18 billion a year dealing with those allergies. I tell you what, it was an amazing figure for me to read, and an amazing book here, as a matter of fact, that we'll be talking with you about for the next 40 minutes or so. The book is called Breathing Space, How Allergies Shape Our Lives and Landscapes. The author is Greg Mittman. Greg is a William Coleman Professor of History of Science at the UW-Madison, Professor of Medical History, Science and Technology, and Environmental Studies. And we're really pleased to have him with us today. He traces the history of allergies from its early beginnings in England to its current dubious position as the leading cause of chronic illness in this country. And it's a fascinating story, and I wanted him to share it with you. So you may have some questions as we move along. I'll remind you that Greg is not a medical doctor. He has a PhD, but not a medical doctor. So he can't answer a specific question about a particular allergy that you might have. But he is certainly has plenty to talk about in this area, especially as it relates to the our environment and how it may relate to allergies. And I'll just stop there and let him talk some more about this. If you'd like to join in, give us a call at 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234. And you can also email us with a question or comment, and the email address is talk@wpr.org. Greg Mittman, welcome.
Thanks for having me, Larry.
Yeah, it's great to have you with us. So the book, been out in hardcover, now just released in softcover not that long ago?
That's correct. About a month ago in softcover.
And, you know, one of the things I noticed when I read through the book, just this is a total aside almost, but so many of the researchers and doctors and physicians who have worked on allergies over the years had suffered from allergies themselves.
That's correct. And there was also a lot of self-experimentation on themselves as they were trying to find new cures and throughout that process.
Yeah. Allergies, did they had their beginnings in England? Is that correct?
Well, there's three classic allergic diseases: hay fever or rhinitis, asthma, and dermatitis. And the book deals really with hay fever and asthma. Hay fever really begins. We see first references to it in the 1830s in England, and it makes its appearance in the United States really in the 1860s after the Civil War. And it really, in the United States, begins as an upper-class disease.
Yeah.
It's really seen as a disease that affects the wealthy and primarily urbanites. And during the late 19th century, one of the popular cures was to create these hay fever resorts. So in areas like the White Mountains of New Hampshire, or in this region,
Mackinac Island.
Mackinac Island was a huge hay fever resort in this area, all along actually the northeastern shore of Lake Michigan. And in Wisconsin, areas like Bayfield really catered themselves to the hay fever tourist trade.
And that was, and these were the well-to-do primarily.
Primarily the well-to-do. It was really, it was seen as a disease closely connected to neurasthenia. And it was seen as a kind of nervous disorder. And it was seen as really affecting those in professions within the city, well-to-do. So it was took on a kind of air of refined sensibility, that these people had refined nerves that made them more susceptible to things in the environment that the poor working class was not.
Oh, man. And of course, that changed a lot over time. But how did it come here? What were its beginnings here in the United States?
Well, really, I mean, it in terms of its beginnings, we don't know whether allergy existed in its form, you know, before people started talking about it as a disease. And we really don't see, as I said, many references to it within both the medical community and the larger population until, in this country, the 1860s and 70s. And during that time period, we now, you know, the biggest allergy season in the United States is the fall allergy season.
Yeah.
We now know that the biggest cause of that is ragweed. And during the 1870s and 80s, when these hay fever resorts became very popular cures, people knew that they had to get out of the city by around August 15th. They didn't know why, but they knew that's when their symptoms would be particularly aggravated. We now know that that's the time when ragweed comes into bloom. And they would go to these areas like Mackinac Island, which were really insulated from the pollen loads and were where ragweed wasn't as prevalent. They didn't know it at the time. They really went to these hay fever resorts and saw nature as a kind of therapeutic cure.
And actually, it worked against some of those areas, if I'm not mistaken, in a way. And we're talking about here not just a couple hundred people.
No,
we're talking thousands of people,
yes,
right?
Yes, yes.
And some huge hotels and facilities. And what did that bring?
Well, I mean, you know, for one, it brought tourism to these areas,
yeah.
And which, you know, so many of these areas, the economies of these areas still rely on the tourism trade, which actually goes back to this period of the hay fever tourism. And it was one of the arguments I make in the book is actually that the fall tourist season in New England really began with hay fever, because most of these hotels would shut down in early August. But most of the hay fever clientele came mid-August and they would stay until the first frost. So as it became clear that this was a wealthy class coming that were going to spend 6 weeks out of the year there, hotels extended the season into October. And so it really creates a longer tourist season. But one of the things that happens as you get more and more people coming into these areas, how do you get those people there? You need railroads. And railroads, what do? They disturb the soil. They turn up the soil. And ragweed is a weed species. It flourishes in disturbed soils.
Soil.
And so one of the things that happens as these areas really... there's a kind of boom economy that's developed in these areas. There's railroads that come. There's increasing presence of ragweed. So they exacerbate the disease and really diminish the therapeutic qualities of those areas. And that's a common refrain that we see in the history of allergy, is the way in which, as we've attempted to alter our landscapes around us or even our bodies, it's led to unintended environmental consequences and often exacerbating the very factors that have contributed to the disease.
And I'm thinking about Arizona as probably a pretty good example of that. Tucson was kind of, at one point, was really considered the place to go.
Absolutely. Tucson was one of the asthma capitals of the world in terms of really catering to the asthma trade, more so asthma than allergy. So people would move there, and rather than be seasonal, they would actually move and stay there. It's estimated that probably over 30% of Tucson's population in the first half of the 20th century were asthma and allergy sufferers. But one of the things that happens as people move there, they really want to recreate the environment that they came from, and they don't particularly like the desert environment. They want to make it look more like the East Coast. So they bring in trees and they bring in Bermuda grass. And some of the trees that they bring in are mulberry and olive trees, which are highly allergenic species. Bermuda grass is a highly allergenic species. So by the 1970s, pollen loads in Tucson had increased tenfold. And now in Tucson, asthma rates are twice that and hay fever six times that of the national average.
Oh, gosh. Greg Mittman, our guest today, he is the author of Breathing Space, How Allergies Shape Our Lives and Our Landscapes. And again, we'll take your calls. In fact, we have lots of callers waiting, so let's go to the phones. Lisa in Madison, you're up. Thank you for waiting. Hi.
Hi there. I wanted to thank the professor for this very interesting topic. And my question is regarding whether he's found anything in his studies, a connection between lawn chemical application and allergies, particularly in children.
Yeah. It's a very interesting question. I can historically, one of the things that happens in the 1940s, as there's increasing concern about ragweed as a public health problem in terms of hay fever, one of the arsenals used in the kind of weapon to treat allergy is the development of 2,4-D, the herbicide. And so communities began spraying 2,4-D as a way of trying to control ragweed. And as much 2,4-D was sprayed for ragweed control in terms of trying to alleviate hay fever as DDT was for mosquito control during the 1940s and 50s in this country. We don't really know the effects of that. We also, more contemporary period, in New York City, one of the big problems in terms of exacerbating factors in asthma is cockroaches. And in fact, more pesticides are sprayed in New York City than all of the agricultural counties of New York State combined. And we don't have really good data on what is the effect of that pesticide exposure in terms of children's health. And how that might actually be exacerbating, particularly autoimmune disorders.
Yeah, interesting. Thank you, Lisa, for calling. Holly in Superior, it's your turn now. Hi, Holly.
Hello, thank you for taking my call. What I'm calling, I have a three-year-old with very severe eczema. And I'm just curious, with all the environmental pollutions, is he more susceptible to the other serious allergies out there? And also, I've heard somebody had suggested giving him honey from our area to help. It's like the flu shot to help build up a immunity to all the allergens out there. And have you found that that works?
Well, as Larry mentioned, I'm not a medical doctor, so I don't want to be involved in diagnosing of your child. The honey, I think, points to there's a whole range of alternative therapeutic practices that have developed over the course of history in terms of dealing with allergy and asthma, going back to the late 1800s. Cocaine was a very popular treatment. Cauterization, where people would actually burn out the sinuses, and there's a whole range of alternative therapeutic strategies that have been put forward, and honey is a strategy that has been advocated within alternative therapeutic communities.
Oh, it has been. Okay. All right. Thanks, Holly. John in Germantown, your turn. Hi, John.
Hi, Larry. Another very interesting program while I'm on the road.
Thank you.
At least now I know why my mother's allergies are so bad, because her neighbor's got a legacy mulberry tree that covers half the
That would do it.
But my question was this. You had mentioned this mainly asthma and allergies. I was diagnosed a while ago with allergies only on one side of my sinus, and I find that hard to believe. Can you tell me the difference between an allergy and a rhinitis?
Rhinitis is basically, it's just another term for hay fever or allergy. So.
Oh, it is. Okay. Yeah. So there, having it on one side of the body.
But that I don't know anything about.
That one we can't help you with, John. But thanks for calling. And Laura in Manitowoc, we'll get to you, and Liz, we'll get to you in just a minute. Just to remind you, our guest today is Greg Mittman. He is the author of Breathing Space: How Allergies Shape Our Lives and Our Landscapes. And you can join us at 800-642-1234. Or email us at talk@wpr.org. I'm Larry Mueller. Jim Packard, our producer here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Talking about the epidemic growth of allergic disease in this country with Greg Mittman. Greg is, I'll remind you, not a medical doctor, but he is, in fact, a professor of history of science at the UW-Madison and has written the book Breathing Space: How Allergies Shape Our Lives and Landscapes. Been out in hardcover for about a year, just came out now in softcover, and really pleased to have him with us. If you have a question, give us a call, 800-642-1234. And Laura in Manitowoc, your turn. Hi, thank you for calling.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I'm just curious. I have allergies to a lot of things and asthma that is triggered by a number of things, but nothing gives me a worse allergic or asthmatic reaction than hay, specifically, literally hay. When I'm around that stuff, I mean, I can barely breathe and my skin itches. And I'm just wondering, the term that we use, the umbrella term, you know, hay fever, mm-hmm. does that have some origins in a specific connection to hay itself?
Yes.
And just anecdotally for your previous caller about the honey, when I have one of these terrible asthmatic reactions, when I was a kid, my aunt used to give me a big tablespoonful of honey, and like no other drug.
Work for you.
Yeah, it totally works. So it's worth a try, and I'll take my answer off the air.
All right.
Thank you. Yes, actually, hay fever, the term has its origins in England in the hay cutting season. So in England, the primary season is in the spring and early summer. In the early summer during the hay season, and that's when people experienced what we would see as allergic symptoms, runny noses, watery eyes, maybe difficulty in breathing, and it's how the term got its name. In the United States, it's a kind of anomaly in the sense because spring and early summer allergies, although they're important to trees and grasses, are not as significant as the fall season, but the hay fever, as the term, makes its way from England into the United States and becomes the common term for all really seasonal allergies.
You know, figuring all this out involves some cooperation between plant experts and plant professors and so forth and the medical profession, didn't it?
It did, and there was, particularly in the early 20th century, a lot of coordination between botanists and pharmaceutical companies and doctors. One of the treatments that's developed and continues today is immunotherapy. And some of our listeners who are allergy sufferers may have had this, where you go and get shots to try and build up the immunity to particular antigens. You would get an extract of something you're allergic to and increasingly up the dose of that. When immunotherapy was first developed, it was developed in New England and in the East Coast, and certain pharmaceutical companies like Letterly Labs started shipping these, they were called pollen vaccines, around the United States, and they would send them, for example, to California, and the doctors would start using these treatments, and they'd say, well, it's not working. And the reason was because the particular plants and pollens that people were subject to in California were, of course, quite
different
than in the East Coast. And so they had to work closely with botanists in figuring out what the ecology of the vegetation was in that region and what plants were actually allergenic species.
Yeah, interesting. Liz in Bristol, it's your turn. Hi, Liz.
Hi, good morning. I'm wondering if in your studies you came across oral allergy syndrome, and if you did, I'm wondering when it first came up and if it's been a growing thing that you're finding in your research. And I'm also wondering, what actually came first? Did you find outdoor allergens came first, or food allergies came first, and did one kind of morph into the other?
I haven't heard about oral allergies. But in terms of the question about outdoor allergens or food allergens, it's a great question. The first allergen that's really identified within the medical community as allergy in the late 19th century shifts from being a kind of nervous disorder to, in the early 1900s, an immunological disorder. And as that happens, there's greater attention placed on specific allergens, and pollen is really the first identified allergen. Food allergies become more widely discerned in the 1920s and 30s. And in the 1930s, we start to see marketing for actually allergic-free diets, things like Rye Crisp and others for people, for example, suffering from different kinds of wheat allergens and so forth. Some of the early food allergies were strawberries was one identified early on, particularly in the 1920s, that people were a food that people were particularly susceptible to. But initially, pollen is the main focus.
Okay. And as we as our environment changed, certainly you document or have quite an account about how the poor in this country have been so negatively affected by allergies.
Right. One of the arguments about the book within the book is really the way in which class has really shaped the history of allergic disease. As I mentioned, hay fever starts off as an upper class disease. That doesn't mean that the poor or people living in, for example, rural areas didn't suffer from allergy, but they really couldn't afford the luxury of the disease in the way in which the rich could. And asthma, currently, you know, there's an urban asthma epidemic that's really affecting the United States and the public health of the United States. So that, for example, in certain inner city communities, largely inner city poor communities of color, like Harlem, where children have 20, it's an estimated 25% of children living in Harlem have asthma. Where African Americans and Latinos have hospitalization and death rates 3 to 5 times that of white middle class patients, so it's a quite serious problem, and there are a host of different kinds of allergens and exacerbating factors within the city that then are quite different than, say, for example, if you're living in Madison. So cockroaches and looking at questions of housing conditions within the city, looking at air pollutants such as where are the majority of bus depots located, and they often tend to be in poor communities of color, so that the poor are really suffering from much greater environmental burdens that exacerbate particularly diseases like asthma.
Abbas and Nina, it's your turn now. Hi.
Hi, thanks for a nice program.
Sure.
My question is about air pressure allergies. Anytime the air pressure goes up, I get a headache and my ears start buzzing really bad. And I'd like to know if you have any information regard to that.
I don't. And you know, allergy in the kind of has common vocabulary often is used to refer to a lot of different things, you know, like we talk about, you know, being allergic to somebody else if we don't like them or something. Within the medical community, allergy has a very specific definition in terms of it's looking at a heightened elevation of IgE antibodies in the body. A lot of other things that people might refer to as allergies would not really be defined as allergies within the medical community.
There have been a lot of treatments for allergies developed, as you were indicating, over the years. And so we've tried to treat the inside of our bodies, more or less, as you point out in your book.
Right. I mean, if you look at the history of allergy, I think you can see three kind of patterns over history. And the first is escape. So moving to these kind of hay fever resorts or moving to Tucson, Denver was another popular place for people to suffer who had asthma. And really only you had to be wealthy or at least of middle class means to be able to do that. The second kind of phase, which really happens around the middle part of the 20th century, is modifying the environment around us. So either, as I mentioned, spraying 2,4-D to try and control ragweed, trying to control the indoor environment. So the rise of air conditioning in the United States is actually closely connected to allergies as a way of insulating the home from outside allergens. And the last really wave is really altering the interior environment of our of the body through chemistry to try and insulate us from the outside world. And so really after the Second World War, the development of a new generations of drugs, and particularly antihistamine, so Benadryl first becomes available in 1946, become widely popular. Antihistamines were the third most prescribed drug in the 1950s, just behind barbiturates and antibiotics. And increasingly, asthma and allergy drugs have become major, major moneymakers for the pharmaceutical industry. Claritin made Schering-Plough $15 billion over the lifetime of its patent. 20% of GlaxoSmithKline's 2005 profits of $32 billion can be accounted for by two drugs for asthma, Flovan and Advair. So it's a really big business right now in terms of pharmaceuticals.
Oh. Joan in Brookfield, on to you now. Hi, Joan.
Good morning.
Morning.
I have a question. The traditional way of checking for allergies was the skin patch test. Is that correct?
That's correct.
And is there anything now as far as taking any blood samples? Has that been another method?
Yes, you're referring to what's called RAS testing, where you would actually take a blood sample and then look at antigen responses in the blood. In fact, my son, who suffers from dermographism, and it basically means writing on the skin. So if you take your finger and kind of just lightly write something on, in about 10 minutes, it'll show up clear as day. And in the summertime, he's been known to sell his back as advertising for kids. But because of that, we could not do scratch tests because obviously any scratch would weld up. And so for listeners who may not be familiar with the scratch test, go back really to the early 1900s, where you would make a scratch or a slight cut into the skin, and then you would rub in something that you suspected that the person was allergic to. So it might be a particular pollen, it could be a food or something like that, and you would see if the skin would weld up. And it's a common way of identifying what people are allergic to. Now, through sophisticated biochemical techniques, we're really you're able to withdraw the blood and then look within at antigen responses within the blood.
Oh. Thanks, Joan, for calling. And Mike in Glenview, Illinois, you are next. Hi, Mike.
How you doing? Good morning, all. I was wondering if there has been any testing linking people that sweat profusely and or body temperature, because I find when I'm sweating and really hot, my allergies really seem to act up. And if there's any link, has there been any drugs that relate to the reduction of sweat and or body temperature to help relieve? If you don't mind, I'm going to excuse myself and listen.
All right.
Not to my knowledge. I don't know of any links between sweating and allergic response. I mean, often sweating or feverishness is seen sometimes as a symptom of a, for example, particularly hay fever, but that there's an actual link, I'm not sure.
Well, and just sort of speculating without any medical background at all, we sweat when we're exerting ourselves. Mm-hmm. And when we're exerting ourselves, that would be a time when I would assume some allergies would likely to become more prevalent.
Well, certainly there's a category known as exercise induced asthma exercise or cold air too can have an exacerbating effect on asthmatic symptoms.
And you talk about when you were a kid, for you, just on the same line, when you were a kid, you couldn't participate in some of the sports you maybe would have liked to have participated in because of that, and the fact of running and football or whatever it might have been. But then over time, when some of the new drugs were developed, this became quite an advertisement for allowing kids or whatever to participate in those things.
It has, and particularly in the 1980s, as this kind of new term exercise-induced asthma comes onto the scene, using athletes to advertise asthma drugs becomes quite popular. And so if you look at, you know, reports of GlaxoSmithKline or Shearing Plough or others that are some of the major manufacturers of asthma drugs, particularly things like bronchodilators, that you see increasingly athletes being used to advertise these. And it really connects to a kind of one of the things I talk about the book in the book is the way in which I think some asthma drugs and can or allergy drugs can be seen as performance enhancing in the sense that, you know, we in our society, we really can no longer afford any downtime, right? That is, you know, you've got to be work, at least 40 hours a week and so forth. And we don't have the luxury of just saying, you know, I can't really suffer through this. And so in terms of thinking about seasonal allergies, a kind of reliance on antihistamines to get through the day so we can be at our optimum work performance, or again, in terms of using bronchodilators for asthmatics so that, you know, the kids can play their best on the soccer field and so forth like that. So I think the way in which kinds of cultural expectations of performance have also come into the way in which we use drugs and think about these allergic diseases is quite important.
Yeah. Is that a good thing?
Is it a good thing? I'm not so sure.
Peter and Stoughton will give you a chance. Hi, Peter.
Good morning.
Morning.
As I was growing up in the 60s, food allergies were pretty rare. And I was wondering if your guest had any comments on the seemingly recent emergence of severe food allergies. I mean, specifically peanuts, for instance.
Yeah. It's a really interesting question. I don't deal with food allergies in the book, but as I mentioned, food allergies do go back to the 1920s. And as you mentioned, you know, there's really serious issues now in terms around things like peanut allergies and people dying of anaphylactic shock from that. You know, we don't really know whether it's because of better reporting and statistics gathering or whether the incidence of particularly peanut allergy has increased and why. I think the jury's still out on that.
We're still not sure. All right. Thank you very much for calling, Peter. Again, you can join us at 800-642-1234 or email us at talk@wpr.org. Let's turn to Ralph in Genoa City next. Ralph, hi. Thank you.
I have two questions.
Okay.
When a person lives in a certain area all their life, they build up, their body builds up resistance to the different allergens or the different things that make you sick. Now, what happens when people, the different ethnic groups mix and in bloods, does that diminish the body's ability to fight off these things?
No.
Although there, you had some, you cited some research in which a physician, I think it was a physician who was not allergic to seafood, I think
it was.
Oh,
that's right, yes.
Actually took some blood.
Right.
Go ahead and explain that.
So, I mean, one of the questions was, really, in the early 1900s, as people were trying to get a handle on what really is allergic disease, and as greater attention is focused on immunological mechanisms, one of the things that you can do is take the blood of an allergic sufferer and inject it into the skin of a non-allergic patient. And then you, for example, this particular case was somebody that had severe seafood allergies. So they took that blood and in this case, he injected it into his stomach and then had a seafood dinner, and it welted up in that area. And again, it's a antigen, antibody response that's being duplicated there but in localized area, not systemic throughout the body.
Not systemic throughout the body. Write in your epilogue that allergy is not a thing but a relation. It's a way of being in the world. And I'd like you to expand on that a little bit.
Sure. I mean, one of the really take-home messages of the book is that in a lot of chronic diseases, we need to think about more ecologically. That is, we need to see these illnesses as a symptom or outcome of particular physical, social, economic relations in the environment. And yet, a lot of the way in which we approach healthcare in American society today is really that search for a magic bullet. So we're trying to find the next drug that's going to, you know, cure all illness. And it works, you know, it worked well for certain kinds of infectious diseases with the rise of the germ theory of disease in the 1880s and, you know, development of treatments and development of antibiotics and so forth. But in terms of chronic diseases like asthma, diabetes is another one. These aren't caused by germs, right? It's not a specific causal effect. And we really need to think about the ways in which, in the case of, for example, inner city asthma, access to healthcare, housing conditions, environmental inequalities of the city, all combine together to make the breathing space of, for example, kids in Harlem not as equitable as those living in, for example, you know, the suburbs. And so that requires a kind of much more holistic approach to thinking about public health than really just going to the drugstore and buying the drug that's going to try and cure your ills. I mean, we've gotten better and better drugs for asthma and allergies, and yet morbidity and mortality rates have continued to climb.
And one more final thing, and with global warming?
Global warming, yes. I mean, there's real connections between global climate change and allergies. There's been studies done recently that show that particularly ragweed, which is a carbon-limited plant, as CO2 levels increase, as they are increasing, and if they, it's estimated that if CO2 levels double, which they might by 2100, if we don't try and reduce greenhouse gas emissions, that the pollen load of ragweed will increase 60%, which is not good for allergy sufferers. The other thing that's happening is ragweed is, you know, it was a North American species. It's now spreading throughout the globe. It's found in areas where it was never found before, also because of different climates in Europe. It's made its way into China. So we may see, you know, an increasing spread across the globe.
Fascinating story you've told in your book, Greg, and thank you so much for being with us today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
Greg Mittman is the author of Breathing Space, How Allergies Shape Our Lives and Landscape. It's an entertaining and informative read, and I certainly recommend it to you. I would have loved to have gotten into the story he told about Mr. T and cutting down all of the trees in his lawn, but you can pick up the book and read it and find out all about that. So we'll leave some things to you to look up in his book when you read it, Breathing Space: How Allergies Shape Our Lives and Landscapes. It's published by Yale University Press. Well, in these economic times, are you making the best airfare purchasing decisions? Rick Seedy of Dallas, Texas, of FareCompare.com is our guest next, and he'll have some advice for you on how to save some money on your next air trip. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.